This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. How do you define a natural ecosystem? Because with the Earth becoming more and more dominated by human civilization, ecologists are beginning to ask how humans fit into the so-called natural world, because there's not a whole lot of natural world left. As our cities, our farms, our suburbs replace wild landscapes, ecologists are paying more and more attention to how nature responds to urban development. And they're coming up with some surprising results. In this hour, we're going to talk about it. Is there more to the urban ecosystem than rats, pigeons, and flu viruses? What makes a city a habitable place to live? And is there such a thing as biodiversity in a city? You don't think about biodiversity in the middle of downtown. Well, maybe there is some of it there. Maybe it's all been weeded out. That's what we're going to talk about this hour. How do you know just what kind of living things inhabit your town? Well, you have to take an inventory. You have to count it. And that's what they're doing today, actually, in New York. Even as we speak, there's an event called BioBlitz, and it's hoping to assess the biodiversity of Central Park. And later in the hour, Undersea Explorer Sylvia Earle will join us. Undersea Explorer, direct from Central Park, where she is, among all things, scuba diving at the bottom of the lake in Central Park. It sounds like something you tell a tourist to do. Go scuba diving, hey, for $20 and go scuba diving in Central Park. But she actually is. And what is she going to find down there? Lord knows, and I'm not sure I want to find out, but we'll talk to her. What could be at the bottom? Maybe Jimmy Ivo will show up. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Nancy Grimm is co-director of the Central Arizona Phoenix Long-Term Ecological Research and professor of biology at Arizona State University. And she joins us from the studios of KJZZ KBAQ in Tempe, Arizona. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks.
Marina Alberti is director of the Urban Ecology Research Laboratory and professor of urban design and planning at the University of Washington. And she joins us from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Fred Koons is director of the New York Bioscape Initiative and executive vice president of the Wildlife Trust based in New York. And he's right here with in our studios here in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
I'm delighted to be here.
Are they really
a break from the Blitz?
Tell us about the Blitz. Are they evaluating everything in Central Park this week?
Well, it's a 24-hour effort. It started at 12 o'clock under great fanfare and celebration. And the teams, actually 350 scientists and amateur naturalists have gotten together. And they're out. They broke themselves into taxonomic groups or different animal and plant groups. Some are doing butterflies. Some are mammals, birds, all the groups you can imagine. And they are going to spend 24 hours counting all the species they can find.
Are there that many to count? You know, people think of New York, they just think of the high-rises.
My guess is that they'll get over 1,000 species in the 24 hours. And I think that's going to shock a lot of people to think that in Central Park, here in the middle of one of the most urbanized places in the world, there is incredible amounts of biodiversity still here.
And Sylvia Earle, what do you think we're going to find at the bottom of the lake at Central Park? I'm speculating all on that.
I am going to leave that one for Sylvia and her experience.
But it's not a dead lake by any means, is it?
No. And again, Central Park is not a dead park at all. Yeah. Just last year, a new species of centipede, of all things, was discovered in Central Park. So still in 2002, we are discovering new species in the middle of Manhattan Island.
It's unbelievable. Nancy Grimm, how do you define urban ecology?
Well, it's difficult to define. I think many people would define it differently, but if we could start by just defining ecology, it's the study of ecological systems, the interactions between organisms and their environment, the flow of energy, the flux of materials. And so urban ecology then translated is the study of those things, of ecological systems that are urban.
Okay. Does that mean that you then study urban ecology similar to the way you would study the ecology of a desert or a forest or a grassland?
Well, that's actually the approach that we're taking to begin with. I think the null hypothesis has to be that urban ecosystems operate according to the same rules as other ecosystems do. It's not really, I guess you wouldn't really say that an urban area is equivalent to a grassland or a forest. Mm-hmm. We can talk about those urban ecosystems being embedded in biomes like grasslands, forests, or deserts. And, for example, the the city that we're studying here in the Central Arizona Phoenix Long-Term Ecological Research Project is embedded in a desert. So it's really potentially quite different than a city that's embedded in a forest.
So what kinds of animals or plants might you find there in that kind of system?
Well, you can find quite a few. Some of them don't belong in the desert necessarily, but this is one of the most interesting things, is that we find that the actions of people is the main factor that contributes to the kinds of plants and animals that we find in this system.
They bring stuff in with them, these people.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the really interesting things that that we found with this LTER project, that's short for Long-Term Ecological Research, this is a program that actually is funded by the National Science Foundation. It's been around for a long time, but this is the first time since 97 that they've actually funded projects to look at cities, to look at urban ecosystems. Mm-hmm. And in terms of biodiversity, we're actually finding some really interesting things. Generally, for some of the groups that we're looking at, biodiversity in the urban system is much higher than it is in the surrounding desert.
The biodiversity is higher inside the place where everybody lives, and in the desert. Well, if they're bringing stuff in with
them
from around the world, you would expect that, no?
Right. So we have biodiversity of native species, and we have biodiversity of imported or exotic species. And when you put those two together, we have a higher biodiversity. Plants, for instance, are much more diverse in the urban area than they are in the surrounding area. Birds, that's also the case. But for some groups, like for arthropods, ground-dwelling insects and other arthropods, we're finding that their biodiversity is not enhanced in the city. In fact, they seem to be more responding to the distribution of the kinds of plants that they depend on, for instance. Mm-hmm. And so those urban arthropods, also because people like to get rid of bugs. So, I mean, there's a lot of controls by humans that are actually acting to reduce biodiversity of invertebrates, mm-hmm. of arthropods, whereas people like plants. And so that actually kind of leads me to one of our most exciting findings to date on biodiversity, which is coming out next week in a Proceedings of the National Academy of Science paper. It's very exciting. We're finding, we've done a very large-scale survey for the whole urban and surrounding region for Central Arizona, looking at plant genera, that is different types of perennial plants. And we found that although there certainly is a response of plant diversity to the typical things that you would expect to see in ecological systems, like topography and other sort of biogeophysical factors, one of the main factors that seems to influence the diversity of plants in urban systems is wealth, is actually a socioeconomic variable, wealth.
Now, wouldn't you expect that wealthier people buy a lot more plants and put them in their backyard?
Well, that's a mechanism that seems to make a lot of sense, actually. it could be that this factor is also correlated with where wealthy people live in environments where that can support a greater number of plants. That could also be the case. It also may be that wealthier people are living in younger housing, because we find that there is a relationship between housing age and diversity as well.
Let me ask Marina Alberti there in Seattle. Are you looking at biodiversity in the urban Seattle area, and what are you finding?
Yes, we are looking at biodiversity in the urban Seattle area. We're particularly looking at focusing on birds, and John Martzleff and Rourke Donnelly have studied the birds and how they respond to the amount of forest covers in area, in an area where there are people and there are development. And they have found an interesting critical threshold, which means that when the level of 30% of forest cover goes below 30% of forest cover, bird diversity drops dramatically. Of course, different species respond differently to different landscapes. So it's important to keep in mind that there is an issue of trying to maintain a diversity of landscape instead of trying to kind of fit with the one solution all kind of urban ecological processes. And that is a very important aspect. We are also looking at ecological condition in streams, and as far as the focus of the research lab that I direct, what we're interested in is whether we can minimize the impact of urban development. There is no doubt that urban development will continue, mm-hmm. and in fact we know that in the next 30 years, the 2 billion people that are predicted to be added to the planet will be in cities. So the question is what urban development patterns we can build that will minimize that effect. And we've looked at the effect of urban development patterns on streams, and particularly we're looking at macroinvertebrates in streams, and we're finding that it's not only the amount of impervious surface that has the greatest impact, but it's also the pattern and distribution of impervious surface, which means that maintaining larger patches of forest is important to actually maintain the hydrological conditions in an urban watershed. And we know also that when we have connected pavement, those are bad, mm. especially when are located in headwaters or near the streams. Also, if you have impervious surface like roads, or you get a dramatic increase in the impact on stream, since roads not only increase impervious surface, but also ditches are built to channel water from roads into streams, and therefore the rate of water runoff is higher. We're also finding that the roads crossing streams are an important predictor of ecological condition of streams. So it's not only the amount of impervious surface that we have to be concerned with, but also the connectivity between those areas. And this suggests to planners, for example, that if we wanted to build cluster or compact development, we still should maintain natural vegetative areas and protect the riparian vegetation, that we still need to retain water, or implement all the possible best management practices to reduce runoff. So those are some of the interesting finding that I think are telling us that we are going in the right direction in terms of studying urban ecology. One thing that I want to say,
sure.
Is that urban ecology is not a new field. In fact, ecologists, hydrologists, engineers, economists, planners have studied various aspects of urban systems for a long time. What is new and what we think is new about urban ecology is how we study these problems. In other words, we're trying to synthesize a large number of disciplines, and instead of separating humans from a natural process, start to see humans as a part of them. And I think that the challenge for urban ecology in the next decades is to actually understand how to achieve that. In one way, we will need to change the way we train ecologists and planners and economists. One thing that we are used to in graduate education is, and we are taught since when we're very young, that we're taught that we need to break apart problems into manageable parts so that we can actually understand and control those problems.
Dr. Alberti, let me yes. stop you there, because we have to take a break. I want to get go back
okay.
and give you a chance to give us a full answer about what you see as the problem on breaking these things
okay.
up. And so stay with us, everybody. Stay with us. We'll take a short break and talk more about urban ecology. So we'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about urban ecology. And when I last rudely interrupted Dr. Marina Alberti, she was telling us about the challenges. Now, we used to think about people being separate from the urban, from the ecology, but now we have to think of them as being part of the environment.
I guess so, because people are part of the environment.
Yeah.
And we have, as I was saying, also we need to change the way we train ourselves, and as ecologists, as planners, as economists. I think all of those disciplines will need to revise themselves. And it was referring to the issue of graduate education, where we're taught to break apart problems mm-hmm. into kind of manageable parts. But the question is, we cannot then reassemble the knowledge that is produced separately from different experts to gain the understanding of the problem as a whole. And I wanted to quote physicist David Bohm when he says that it's like trying to reassemble the fragments of a broken mirror to see a true reflection. Mm. In fact, you will end up giving up this because consider, for example, the problem of contaminated salmon spawning streams due to surface runoff in Seattle. If you look at the different contribution or different disciplines that are involved in understanding the problem, for a wastewater engineer, the problem may be one of providing adequate capacity for storm sewer and appropriate treatment of outfalls to meet certain standards. For the ecologist, the problem may be in terms of restoring the stream habitat, or mm-hmm. For an economist, it would be more to best maximize the economic benefits or minimize the cost of providing infrastructure. And a planner would think about what zoning could protect the encroachment of riparian areas. But while those experts are able to study and optimize individual solution for separate problems, they do not know how to design solutions that address many problems simultaneously. And this is the challenge of urban ecology. This is what we can do differently. And we will need to retrain ourselves, as I said, as a planners. And this is this is what we are trying to do, both, I think, also in Phoenix, the Urban Ecology LTR, as well as in Seattle, in the Urban Ecology Program.
Let me just bring in somebody else who's waiting on our cell phone. Dr. Sylvia Earle is at the BioBlitz today in Central Park, and she's I understand it, Dr. Earle, you've just come out of the lake at Central Park. Is that right?
Absolutely. I'm still a little green from all the algae. It's like diving in the Emerald City.
How deep is it? What did you do? Give us a little synopsis.
Well, the maximum depth there is about 12 feet, 4 meters. And amazingly, it's very warm at the surface and very cold at the bottom. There's a thermocline even in this shallow water.
And what did you expect to find down there?
Well, I expected to see some insects, and I had hoped to see one of the legendary snapping turtles that ply the waters of Central Park. Actually, we did see the head of a turtle emerge, but I didn't see one while underwater. It's a little murky for that.
Any of those famous New York City alligators down there?
Well, we didn't see any of them, but they may have seen some of us.
You didn't see things that you were hoping not to see, did you?
Well, no. We had some mighty explorers there, though, from the Explorers Club. We actually took one of the flags. Those flags go to the top of Mount Everest and to the deepest oceans. And we had one in the deepest part of Central Park today. It was great.
On a serious note, though, you're part of this effort to try to sort of assess what everything is living in Central Park, right?
Yeah, this is part of a celebration of the 150th anniversary of Central Park. And we're saluting those who, a century and a half ago, had the good common sense to establish this beautiful green place in the middle of the city. And we are here for the first time in all of this time, really trying to take a serious inventory of all of the plants, the animals, the little critters, the big critters, even the people, of course, that make up this park. As the person you were just interviewing noted, we're a part of the system, and it's nowhere more evident than here in Central Park.
So are you done exploring the lake?
Well, no, some people are still out there. We're going in teams, and I was out there with Richard Weiss, who's the president of the Explorers Club, and Ken Kamler, who's a doctor of extreme environments. And this is an extreme environment, I can tell you. And we just got out, and another team went in. They are still paddling around out there, hoping to find some fish. So far, we have not actually seen fish, but it's pretty green. It's a pond. One of the things that we've concluded is that we can make this place better than it is at this point in history, so that maybe 150 years from now, people will be thanking us as we are thanking our predecessors for the good sense to really protect places like this.
Greening meaning it's overrun with nutrient runoff that feeds the algae, something like that?
It certainly appears that way. Now, I'm a great fan of green and blue. I'm a biologist, and, you know, I'm an explorer in residence at the National Geographic, and I'm working with Conservation International, and we've been looking at special places of high biodiversity all over the planet, for me, especially in the ocean, and doing our best to find the ways and means to protect them, because these places are really important. They're vital to our survival, our well-being, as well as to refresh our minds and spirits.
Well, in New York, being surrounded by an ocean, an estuary, all kinds of stuff, as a natural wildlife preserve right by the biggest airport, it's a little bit of a dichotomy, isn't it? All these living things in a hugely urban environment. There are some spottings of seals, right, in Long Island Sound? And
absolutely. Horseshoe crabs, a lot of things that are really relics of times of from long ago that we still are able to enjoy today. And one of the great convergences of technology and nature we're experiencing here, Microsoft is cooperating with us to make available technology to help not only inventory, but to provide the basis for tracking through time the critters that we're finding. It's really a terrific kind of partnership.
All right. Well, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us, Dr. Earle. If you find a Judge Crater down there, would you let us know?
We have our eyes wide open and never know what we're going to find. We'll let you know.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sylvia Earle, who is a well-known marine biologist, explorer, deep-sea diver, diving all of 12 feet, did you say? 12 feet into the lake in Central Park, the very famous lake in Central Park. It's part of the BioBlitz, which is a 24-hour attempt by a team of scientists to inventory the many organisms down there. Sitting with me is Fred Coons, director of the New York Bioscape Initiative of the Wildlife Trust in New York City. Anything surprising that she said?
No, I don't think so. I think we'll have the results tomorrow.
But she did say she thought it was murkier or greener than she had expected.
It was also very interesting when she commented that perhaps from this BioBlitz we'll learn information that we can improve the park. And I think that's one of the big challenges also of urban ecology, is how we can understand how the spaces that we share with nature, people and nature share, some people call this reconciliation ecology. How can we maximize the amount of biodiversity in shared spaces? Because after all, in the next few decades, only somewhere between 5% and 15% of land is going to be in protected areas. And I think especially in more urbanized areas and human-dominated landscapes, the key is going to be, you know, how much wildlife, how much nature can we save between the parks? And that's a big focus of the New York Bioscape Initiative.
And we also see it in New York. We see nature encroaching on the city as the city moves northward in the suburbs and Westchester, other places. Wasn't there a recent sighting of coyotes in, close to town? And
there's a surprising number of coyotes in very suburban areas. I think another challenge for the urban ecologists is to get people to think a little bit more blurry about where does the city actually end? And at Wildlife Trust and at the New York Bioscape Initiative, this collaboration of 34 scientists from 15 institutions now, they're looking really at city regions. And we think that very much like we've heard already today, multidisciplinary efforts are going to be needed. But we also have to find compelling ways for people that live in these human-dominated landscapes to get more connected with nature. And we think the role of ecological health, including the health of people, is a key factor in this effort.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's get a few phone calls here. Some interesting calls from Mike. Mike in Ithaca. Hi, Ithaca, New York.
Hi, Ira. Good afternoon. I just want to, I don't know if there's so much I could say. It's kind of hard to weed it out. But I grew up in the Bronx, and since I was 2 years old, my father used to take me to the woods around the zoo and the botanical garden, and I explored empty lots and became a naturalist and even a biologist later in life. And I was always fascinated by the variation within species, the diversity within species, so I did become a geneticist. But I was quite fascinated by jewelweeds and crow garlics, and was fascinated by both species because they have this mixture of both sexual reproduction and asexual, or in the case of the jewelweed, self-mating and outcrossing-type flowers on the same plant. And yet there was a lot of diversity in terms of flower color, flower shape within these species. And I also was quite interested in the pollinators and the bees and the wasps, and found quite a bit of, again, within species diversity. And even some species that would be considered rare and obscure, I found, like Ponera pennsylvanicus, which is a very primitive ant, and one would the last thing one would expect to find. One thinks of Ponerine ants as tropical, and I also There's a obscure bee, Procellostoma philadelphi, that looks like a flying ant. It's a very tiny little bee that lives in holes left behind by beetles and wood. And I knew of two places in the Bronx where there were nest aggregations of these. Mm. And there were many other species, too, that fascinated me, like Lasius alienus. It's a variant on the cornfield ant, but unlike the cornfield ant, it has many queens per colony instead of one. And I learned
you shouldn't have moved to Ithaca. You had such a good time.
It was great, but unfortunately, I was advised by a psychiatrist that I was in danger of being stalked by a serial killer, and for my own safety, was asked to leave. And I miss it greatly. I had a wonderful time in the Bronx, and I had a rather large wildflower book my grandma gave me when I was 12, and I could find almost any flower in that book if you were willing to walk as far as an hour. In Ithaca, it's only 5 minutes.
Yeah. Mike, I got to go. We have a couple more calls.
Take care, mate.
Thank you for calling, 1-800-989-8255.
Can I make a comment?
Sure, please. Go ahead.
I actually think that one of the reasons for an interest in biodiversity, even in the city, is exactly as the caller was just relating. I mean, people relate to nature and to organisms of different types, and it's a wonderful thing to have a central park and that sort of thing. I think what people don't realize quite as often is that natural ecosystems and ecosystems within cities, and I would argue cities themselves as ecosystems, have a set of services that they provide that are underappreciated and that we really need to understand better. And this is one of the reasons why we're quite interested in CAPLTER and in looking at multiple scales of ecosystem and human interaction, both in individual backyards all the way up to the city and how it interacts with the region and nation. And I think it's an important thing, lesson that the public and through our education we need to sort of transmit, is that in addition to the fact that biological ecological systems are fascinating and interesting, they also provide very important services on which humankind depends. And in agreement with Marina's comments about the need for urban ecology, people could ask us, why are you doing this? I mean, it's not really as attractive a place to study ecosystem processes as, say, a desert stream or a mountain or something like that. But it's absolutely essential that we do it because, as Marina said, more and more people will be living in cities. We have to figure out a way in these very highly modified ecosystems to continue to work to make these systems function in ways that can provide those kinds of services on which we depend and can make our lives better. And I think it's really critical that we recognize that aspect of ecology as well as the sort of gee whiz, wow, biodiversity aspect of ecology.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about urban ecology this hour on Talk of the Nation, Science Friday from NPR News. Let's go to John. I think John is in Kansas City. Hi, John.
Hi. I belong to the Kansas City Wildlands here in Kansas City, and it's a coalition of nonprofit natural resource related organizations. And we do prairie restorations. And we just, 2 weeks ago, did our second annual BioBlitz in this area. And as soon as I heard that on the radio, the word BioBlitz, you know, I picked up. I was out in the field and had to run back to my office to get on the line. Your guest had mentioned funding from the National Science Foundation. Funding is something that we're always looking for. And we really beat the bush on this on our second BioBlitz. If your guest has any suggestions on funding for this type of project, we plan on having annual BioBlitzes scattered in our different restoration sites and other places around the Kansas City metro area. If your guest has any suggestions for funding.
I don't know if they're going to give you their secrets. They want the money too, I would imagine. I've never heard anybody else ever give away their funding secrets, but maybe we'll have a first.
I think there's a number of programs in different cities and state level that some of them are federal, like the Fish and Wildlife Service providing funding for urban biosurveys. That kind of thing goes on here.
But states and municipalities are so strapped for cash now, they're never going to do this on their own, are they?
I mean, yeah. I think as they see that it's more important, they do.
I would encourage you to really think locally for this kind of effort, because I think another byproduct of the BioBlitz is the great need for us to develop a stronger sense of place around our country and world. And I think that getting out and finding the organisms in your own backyard and getting local organizations to support that effort is a really good tool to get this idea of sense of place, of where we live and what's there. You know, it's wonderful when people have the opportunity to travel the world and go to the Amazon and all these great biodiversity-rich areas. But, you know, there's so much in your own backyard, and there's so much you can do. So I would actually encourage you not to seek out federal and state funding, but to seek out the local businesses and the local folks in your area and get them to tie into the BioBlitz as a way to really strengthen local awareness.
I find it funny you said Microsoft did this New York BioBlitz.
No, they are doing a technology test of a new computer system that could be used all over the world. Mm-hmm. But again, most of the effort for raising the funds for the Central Park BioBlitz came from 11 local organizations.
Mm-hmm. If I can interject on this issue, I'd like to mention that I think that even, first of all, if we can protect biodiversity within urban areas, that's great. But even if we will not be able to manage to protect biodiversity in urban areas, still I believe and agree with the people mentioned before that we cannot protect wildland if we don't make our cities more livable, and if we don't integrate natural features in our city, if we don't maintain some level of ecological functionings within the city. So what, in order to protect pristine areas outside the urban area, we will need to maintain and make more cities more livable. And that's the critical element that people often think that there is
Dr. Alberti, I have to interrupt again. I'm sorry. I keep interrupting you. We'll come back and let you finish your thought, because we've got to take care of business first. So don't go away. We'll take a short break and come back and talk lots more about urban issues. So stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about urban ecology with my guest, Nancy Grimm, co-director of the Central Arizona Phoenix Long-Term Ecological Research at Arizona State University. Dr. Marina Alberti, director of the Urban Ecology Research Laboratory, University of Washington. And Fred Koons, director of the New York Bioscape Initiative and at the Wildlife Trust in New York City. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Dr. Alberti, you were telling us that to keep the biodiversity going, we've got to keep our cities.
We need to protect our cities. We have to reinvest in our city. In a sense, we have to reinvent our city in a way in which we can achieve a balance between ecological functioning and human services. And I believe that means that we need to change also radically the way we think about planning for those cities. For example, I think that there is an interdependence between all the different landscapes that we need to maintain. So in order to maintain healthy wildland, we also need to create cities where those ecological functions that are possible, that can be maintained within the cities, are still maintained. We need to create environments that will keep people in. It's clear that cities without nature will become unbearable, and people is drawn to natural setting, which is one of the reasons why also people prefer the fringe. It's not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons that makes people go away from the city. In fact, I would ask New Yorkers what would they say if Central Park would be all paved. I don't think they would like that. So I think it's an important aspect of understanding the interdependence of all those landscapes and think about biodiversity when we plan our cities.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Jack in Eagle River, Wisconsin. Hi, Jack.
Yeah, hi. I just want to point out, I visited many cities in the United States, and really Chicago seems to have a unique feature with the forest preserves that completely surround the city. Not only do you have golf courses, picnic areas, bike paths, and things like that, but you have wide, vast areas with wildlife. And somebody by the name of Burnham, they tell me, planned this many years ago, as well as the waterfront where they have, you know, where they can't develop right close to the lake. And as I say, I've been to practically every city in the country, and I've never seen anything quite like that. Mm. You don't hear much about it.
Fred, true?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Chicago also, in recent years, has a wonderful consortium. I think it's nearly 200 organizations now called Chicago Wilderness. And it's all about really finding a way to merge the sense of wilderness with the city of Chicago. And again, it's a regional approach of urban ecology and people and nature living together. But I think you're right. Chicago deserves our praise.
Thanks for calling.
Sure.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about urban ecology this hour. Let's go to San Francisco. Laurie, is it Leroy?
Yes. It's Francois. I'm in Pacific Heights, just a short distance from the newly formed Presidio, a historical district, national park. I have sort of a three-part question. First of all, I'd like to say that Science Fridays is really a priority for everyone, and we hope you get more support and attention. It really means a lot
Thank
to
you.
Us.
Thanks.
I was wondering, with your special guest, her being a diver, whether she is allowed to say or has observed toxic excipients in the water.
She's gone back diving, so she's not on the line with us. We can't ask her about that.
Well, the reason I ask is because my father was a diver for the Navy for 30 years, and one of their biostations was strategically located in an exact position on an estuary where the salinity of the water changed sometimes several times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they had to do, you know, various types of testings. Of course, right now I'm, you know, in light of the, you know, of the past recent 3 years, we're wondering about radiological excipients in the water, in not only in flowing water but in still water, groundwater.
It's a good question. Let me ask Fred about this. Fred, you have a city, you have a lake, you have, you know, it's captive. You worry about stuff building up in the water supply.
In the New York Bioscape Initiative, which again is a 100-mile region around the city, the toxicology problems and the environmental contaminant problems, there's been a lot of progress over the last 30 years, a tremendous amount of progress, but we're still very, very concerned about it. And there's actually a whole new kinds of environmental contaminants that are really raising red flags. We're really concerned about things that you wouldn't think about, like caffeine. We all enjoy coffee. Caffeine is showing up in all kinds of places.
Right.
Antibiotics that we take, of course, to help us stay healthy. You know, people throw the extra last couple pills out.
Down the toilet?
Down the
goes
toilet,
right?
And it goes into our watersheds. And, you know, we don't really know what's happening.
Estrogens are showing.
This is what, in our initiative, there's a relatively new scientific discipline, which, again, is another one of these multidisciplinary efforts, called conservation medicine. And it's really to address these kinds of issues. We're looking for the links between wildlife health, human health, and ecosystem health. And I think the caller has a good point that, you know, some of these traditional concerns are resurfacing again, and there's new twists to these and needs our focus.
I have to agree strongly with that. I think it's a very important new area, and it especially is going to be prevalent in cities. And so people who are doing ecological and other studies in cities need to pay some attention to the sort of interaction of human health and ecosystem health. A lot of progress has been made on cleaning up wastewater, for instance, very sophisticated methods of treating wastewater, and yet some of those were not designed with the knowledge that we would have all of these new compounds that are in the environment and that are moving around in the environment. And so the kinds of methods that we've used, and we've made great progress in cleaning water, are maybe not applicable to that. And more from a sort of just a pure scientific point of view, this is in sort of the class of things that I think, you know, personally I have a great interest in, the extent to which my null hypothesis that I told you, which is that ecological systems that our cities are operate under the same rules and with the same kinds of processes and patterns as any ecosystem, if that proves not to be true, then we need to look to what are the possible mechanisms that can make these urban ecological systems operate differently. What are some of the things that would make biogeochemical cycles, for instance, be different in cities? And does that have something to do with the fact that humans are such a prevalent part of the system? And how can we change our ecological models and our understanding in order to incorporate the feedbacks from humans to ecological systems, vice versa? And those are the kinds of things that we're focusing on and sort of bringing in multiple disciplines, people from many, many different areas, because these problems are way too complex for one type of segment of society or of science to deal with.
But so you
they're way too complex to leave to politicians or to leave to engineers to come up with a solution or to leave to ecologists.
You could say that humans are the ultimate alien species that invade a neighborhood.
A lot of people like to say that, actually.
You know, is that right?
That's a real favorite thing to say.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I thought I was being original.
The exogenous perturbing force, as a friend of mine is wont to say. There are over 6 billion people on this planet, and there is no place on this planet that isn't touched by humans. Mm-hmm. And cities are a really good place to start to look at how human ecosystem interactions can really change an understanding of how ecological systems function. If there's a big change, we're going to find it in the cities.
And I think
if there's a big effect, we're going to find it in the cities. Mm.
We're talking about urban ecology this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Fred, you want to say?
And I think the cities and the metropolitan regions are also excellent laboratories to figure out, once the scientists, these multidisciplinary complex teams of scientists, once they come up with some new knowledge, it's also a good testing ground for then how are the educators going to get this knowledge out into the hands of people so that maybe they don't throw that cup of coffee out on the ground and it gets into the watershed. And so it's really a system of knowledge production, but then also getting that knowledge out to people so that they change their behavior and it will feed back and actually change the system that the scientists are studying.
Let's go to Robert.
I have one more comment, and that was, as well as the public, we also need to get this information to people who are making decisions at a variety of levels. And individuals, of course, make decisions, but so do local governments, state governments, and national governments. And here at Arizona State, we have a project that's related to this basic ecological science project, which is the LTER project. But this project is designed to take the data and sort of bring that into a realm, a system, a project in which policymakers, decision makers can think about with scientists and envision the future for a city like Phoenix. What will Phoenix be like in 2100? And if we don't like what we can predict it's going to be like, then what can we do about it right now using the scientific data that we've been getting?
Let me see if I can get a quick call in from Robert in Cottonwood, Arizona. Hi, Robert, quickly.
Yes, hi. I was just going to question and comment for Dr. Grimm from Arizona State University, and it has to do precisely with what she's talking about, and that is the question of the sustainability of Phoenix in the desert when the lifestyle that's promoted in Phoenix is ignores the fact that they live in a desert and that the rural parts where I live are directly impacted. We end up with severe water shortages, and they have this incredible waste of water in Phoenix with all the swimming pools, Tempe Town Lake, Fountain Hills, a huge fountain going 200 feet into the air.
All right, it's good, a good point. Let me see if I can get an answer to that.
That's a great question, and I think it is a problem, but there's a couple of things I want to say. First of all,
I've got about a minute left.
Okay, my colleague says that some of the most successful and longest-term urban civilizations, my colleague Chuck Redmond tells me, occurred in arid environments where people are able to capture and manipulate the water. But I recognize that there is a big problem, and you know, until we have to actually pay for the water that we use here, people are going to continue to rampantly use water.
But water is the biggest, going to be the biggest issue in the West coming up.
It will be. It is already the biggest issue in the West. And yet, because over 90%, I think for a very long time, over 90% of the water use was for agriculture. As agriculture is converted to urban lands and the per acre use goes down, we can support a lot more people in Phoenix. Phoenix has grown from about 2 million to over 3 million in the last decade. And there's no sign that that growth is slowing down at all.
But what a consequence for the air pollution that's going on over there.
There are important air pollution consequences. There are water quality consequences and a variety of other things. And these are the issues that we have to deal with.
All right.
And again, as Marina said, we have to deal with those with multiple disciplines, with a lot of people working together and coming at this problem together.
All right. Time is the issue. I have to deal with it. We've run out of time. Let me thank my guests this hour. Nancy Grimm is co-director of the Central Arizona Phoenix Long-Term Ecological Research and professor of biology at Arizona State University in Tempe. Marina Alberti is the director of the Urban Ecology Research Laboratory and professor of urban design and planning at the University of Washington in Seattle. And Fred Coons is director of the New York Bioscape Initiative and executive vice president of the Wildlife Trust based here in New York City. Thank you all for joining us this hour and taking time to talk with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're
welcome.
Have a good weekend. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineer is Matt Galick in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Kima Leski and Alphonse Vinn. If you missed any of the links, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is there, which has free curricula, right for years for teachers who want to teach curricula based on Science Friday. It's all up there. Also, back editions of Science Friday on real audio. You can also take them away and listen to them later on your audible.com player. So lots of audio files available for you. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flato in New York.